Hey there, you're listening to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White and Chris Hemmelman of Cornvale Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're continuing to tackle the question, what is marriage?
Last week, we started this conversation really saying that our discussions in the culture and as Christians about marriage need to have this question at the core. What is marriage? If we don't know what it is, we can't argue about whether it should be granted to these or those persons. So we started last week with a good, robust conversation about what it is. I want to come back to that conversation and continue it this week. Again, the book that we're sort of drawing out of, although whatever we say that's less intelligent than what the authors say, blame us for that, not them. But the book is What is Marriage? By Sharif Girgis, Ryan T. Anderson, and Robert George. Very, very interesting natural law defense of marriage. And Dusty, you had a quote in this book that I think gets us right into the topic of conversation today, which is sort of sexual complementarity and why is that foundational to marriage?
Yeah, the quote I'm going to read here is where they're just arguing for the bodily union of marriage and basically saying, until you have the bodily union expressed in marriage, you're not truly married. Listen to this. Suppose a man and a woman build an exclusive relationship based on deep conversation. They pledge to talk about their most secret sorrows and joys with each other, and only each other, until death do them part. Have they married? Clearly not, they say. If we substitute for deep conversation some more overtly physical act besides sex, they still are not yet married. Marriage requires exclusivity with respect to sex, to a certain kind of bodily union. But what makes sex so special? Our bodies can touch and interact in all sorts of ways, so why can sexual union make two people one body or one flesh, to cite an ancient Hebrew scripture? And then jumping down a little bit, they say this, in short then, your organs are one body because they are coordinated for a single biological purpose of the whole that they form together, sustaining your biological life.
All right, so this is deep philosophical water here, and I'm going to ask our listeners to hang with us because these authors are working out of sort of some Aristotelian categories that for modern educated people, we don't think as deeply as this often. And so let me bring you into the philosophical tradition here. There's a tradition in philosophy that speaks of final ends or final causes. In other words, what is something ordered toward naturally? Okay, so in other words, your mouth is ordered toward eating by virtue of its design. Your nose is ordered toward smelling by virtue of its design. And what these authors are saying is your sexual organs, male and female, are ordered toward coming together for the purpose of producing life, producing offspring. The fact that they can come together without doing that does not change the fact that they are ordered toward that end and that goal and that purpose. And therefore, because that's the coming together of a husband and wife sexually is naturally, by design, ordered in that direction, no other type of relationship is ordered in that way. And when I say ordered, I'm using it in a sort of philosophical way, that it's designed or it tends or it lends itself in that direction. It's, think about it as an arrow that's pointed toward something. That's when a man and woman come together, their coming together is pointed toward the conception of a child, which is why some people in our culture spend lots of money to make sure that doesn't happen, because ordered, left to itself, that's what will happen, unless artificial processes are in place or unless there's some functional problem in terms of how those bodies work. But they're ordered toward that. And that's an interesting – these authors are saying that's part of the foundational definition of marriage. That's part of what makes a marriage. And therefore, no same-sex relationship of any kind can be called a marriage because it's not ordered toward the producing of life in that way. Now, this is a well-traveled argument in Catholic circles. Protestants do a lesser job of really understanding the connection of procreation to sexuality. And this is probably something we need to sort of right the ship on, is connecting the dots and saying that part of the function of marriage is to have children. We see that not just in Scripture. We see that in the design of our bodies. We see that in the natural outcome of people having sex with one another. This is what this is ordered to. And so because it's ordered in that direction, it's part of what makes a marriage a marriage and what makes all other kinds of relationships something different than marriage. Before we turned on the microphones, Chris Hemmelman had this this analogy that I think might be helpful. He likes to eat ranch with his French fries.
Yum.
Gross.
Come on.
I prefer I prefer ketchup. But so though Chris might prefer to eat ranch with his French fries, there's nothing inherent about French fries and ranch dressing that must go together, that yay, in fact, have to go together, that they are ordered to be together by the function of their of their design. Okay? It's just a preference. Chris likes to dip his French fries in ranch dressing or whatever.
That's too bad.
However, if you think about your shoulder socket, which is a ball and socket that inherently are made to fit together for the sake of the functioning of your arm, or if you think about an electrical outlet and the plug of your vacuum cleaner, that those by design and function are made to go together, and that they don't perform their function unless they are connected to one another so that electricity can flow to that appliance and cause it to work. That's an example of things that are ordered together functionally, and that's something much deeper and much more deeply wedded to objective reality. And so what these authors are saying is that our human bodies are made in a way that objectively is intended to fit together. And this is part of, I think, even what we see in Paul's argument in Romans chapter 1. I think there's ways that we can misread that argument in a simplistic way. But essentially, when he said, when he talks about idolatry and says that part of the sort of implications of idolatry, one of the things that we see culturally is he talks about women exchanging the natural function for the unnatural. And there's a lot of people on both sides that make much of the words natural and unnatural. But I think Paul's thinking like a good Greek. He's just saying they're not ordered toward the reproductive function in the way that a male and female body are. There's an inherent union of persons that results in the reproduction of other persons. And something about that is deep, mysterious, important, and significant, and it's foundational for how we understand marriage and sexuality. And so this is important to the conversation about marriage, because I think a lot of times the way this goes is, well, if two heterosexual people can be in love with each other and have an orgasm, why can't other types of pairs be in love with each other and have orgasms? And it's not about that. It's about what is proper, what are our bodies ordered toward, and what is the natural and intended outcome of marriage. And in every tradition, philosophical, historical, cultural, and religious, a marriage is not a marriage unless those two parties consummate it through the sexual act. And a marriage is not a marriage unless one of the intended outcomes of marriage is children. Not that there aren't childless marriages, not that there aren't infertile people, but that the natural outcome of a marriage, all things considered and all things working properly, is the having of children. And this is a really interesting wrinkle in the sort of question of what is marriage.
What I think this discussion on marriage reveals in many ways is how philosophically, theologically, culturally, over the past 30, 40 years now, that we've lost in many ways this notion of human nature. We've lost an understanding of what it means to be human. And in many ways, so we've lost our humanity in that what is inherent in us, what makes us distinct as human beings. And just for a second, just leave being created in the image of God out of it. You don't even need to go there, but just what is natural to humans and what society and civilization has recognized for centuries and millennium, now we completely have thrown out the window. And it's just an ironic aspect of this. In doing that, we've lost our humanity. And so to make an argument that there's an inherent human nature, there's these natural functions that go part and parcel with being male, with being female, with having a marriage relationship, to deny that is to say, no, you're less than human, you're something else, or that what it means to be human is so culturally situated that it has no definition. And so this is sort of a philosophical irony here.
Well, you're exactly right, Chris, and that's one of the hard things about listening to sort of the way these arguments go in the culture is that people are missing so many just foundational pieces of starting points. And what is it to be human? Let's start with objective human nature, and I think you're exactly right that that's not just in the last 20 or 30 years, but probably since the Enlightenment, that's been increasingly less and less part of the conversation. But it matters very deeply because all of us know there's something intrinsic about us that makes us human. And, you know, the Bible calls that the image of God. But whether you call it the image of God or not, we all know there is something intrinsic and objective about humanness. And the less we think about that and the less we import that into our debates and arguments about things like morality, the more we miss the point.
Yeah, we see this too in discussions about abortion or medical ethics as well. So, I mean, it's far-reaching, but the consequences of this are just tragic. And I keep going back to thinking how ironic this is, because those who argue against this in many ways say they're arguing for a deeper human dignity, but we lose it. We're actually losing it.
Yeah, they just want to be who they are, right? But in so doing, they've emasculated themselves and defeminized themselves. And so really, they haven't embraced who they are. They've tried to change who they are. And so we would just say, right, like the body is divine and gender is divine. And that begins, God begins that when he creates you, either with a Y chromosome or not, you know. And so gender matters, and therefore complementary and bodily marriage matters.
Let me read a quote from this book. I want to help people understand the nature of the discussion here. Everyone knows that marriage is a kind of relationship. An account of marriage must explain what makes the marital relationship different from others. So they're just doing good work here. They're saying, okay, marriage is a kind of relationship. So anyone who wants to define marriage has to explain, how is the marriage relationship different from friendship, or different from being a brother and sister, or different from playing on a soccer team together? What's distinct about this kind of relationship? They go on to say, in our view, the kind of union created by consent to marriage is uniquely comprehensive in three ways. Number one, how it unites persons. Number two, what it unites them with respect to. And number three, how extensive a commitment it demands. So now they're going to build out these three categories. Okay, marriage is comprehensive in how it unites persons, what it unites them with respect to, and how extensive a commitment it demands. Okay, first, marriage unites persons in their bodies as well as their minds. The bodily union of two people is much like the bodily union of organs in an individual. Just as one's organs form a unity by coordinating for the biological good of the whole, so the bodies of a man and a woman form a unity by coordination, coitus, for a biological good, reproduction, of their union as a whole. That is a fascinating sentence to me. I'm going to stop there for a minute, because there's so much philosophical depth in that we miss. So what they're saying are that the bodies of a man and woman form a unity through the sexual act that reproduces their union as a whole, which is fascinating to think about, that your kids are not just you or just your wife. They're a reproduction of your union. They carry a different set of genetic makeup that's passed on to them by the coming together of a husband and a wife. And that's profound and deep, right? So it really does reproduce the union as a whole. Okay, they go on to say, also, spouses unite bodily only by coitus, which is ordered toward the bringing of a new human life into the world. We've already talked about that. New life, in a sense, is one human good among others, but in another sense, it transcends and includes other human goods. Having consented to sharing in the generative acts that unite them organically, spouses cooperate in other areas of life, intellectual, recreational, etc., in the broad domestic sharing uniquely apt for fostering the all-around development of new human beings. Okay, so we would agree with this, because we'd say what makes a marriage different from a guy getting a woman pregnant and then bailing on her is a marriage says we're going to cooperate together in actually raising these children, the product of our union, instead of just enjoying the experience and abandoning the child and leaving it to be raised by someone else. All right, so that the marriage is uniquely coordinated in terms of the not just the producing of offspring, but the commitment to raise, care for, train, and partner in the raising of those children. Finally, in view of its comprehensiveness in these other senses, marriage inherently calls for comprehensive commitment, permanence, and exclusivity. Marriage is uniquely apt for having and rearing children, an inherently open-ended task calling for unconditional commitment. But friendships as such require no promise of permanence and are enhanced, not betrayed, by openness to new members. So they're saying that a marriage, because it requires an open-ended commitment to raising these children, has inherent in it a promise of permanence and exclusivity, because that is what it takes to do this, and that's different than a friendship where it doesn't have to be permanent, doesn't have to be exclusive. So in short, this is their summary. Marriage involves a bodily as well as mental union of spouses, a special link to children and domestic life, and a permanent and exclusive commitment. All three elements converge in and constitute the conjugal view of marriage. Now, I think that's a really thoughtful and helpful explanation of this view of marriage. And I would also say, I think that is a philosophically rigorous definition of marriage that requires a refutation from someone who would say, no, that's not what marriage is. So these guys are saying, nope, this is what marriage is. Someone who wants to argue that marriage is something else needs to tackle our three points here, that this is a comprehensive union of persons, and explain how marriage is not that and doesn't have to be ordered toward that, but could be some different kind of relationship. And as such, they're sort of throwing down the philosophical gauntlet and saying, we leave it up to someone else to say why marriage doesn't have to have these three distinctive components. But in any case, clear connection between the definition of marriage and the understanding of the complementarity of sexes.
That definition, I think, really gets into what Scripture would call one flesh relationship. I think that is a very well-articulated description of the implications of one flesh relationship and the power of that. I think that's what I really liked about that quote is this is just, no pun intended, pregnant with power.
Wow.
That was actually
you couldn't get away from the pun there.
That was a little bit of a pun.
But so just the inherent nature of what marriage is, and by definition, if we're going to use this, how we've been talking about, there's an inherent nature here that anything less than that, you can call it whatever you want, civil union, call it just
domestic partnership,
whatever it may be, but don't touch the institution of marriage. I mean, that's essentially what they're arguing here. You can't touch this. Is there a place for Christians to be okay with that? To say, okay, here is the institution of marriage. We get this. This is what this is defined as. You can have these other things, but just don't call it marriage. Is that okay for a place? Is it okay for Christians to say, yeah, civil unions, fine?
Yeah, that's interesting. And that probably the answer to that question probably is open, depending on your view of political involvement, right? Because if you have more of a – if you're trying to live in a pluralistic society and leave room for people who disagree, you probably would say, well, yeah. So let's acknowledge that there are people who want to live in domestic partnerships. That's great. Let's call it something different than marriage. We can agree to live and let live. There might be other Christians who have a more robust view of sort of a leaning more in the direction of like a – I don't want to say theocracy, but more in the sort of reconstructionist point of view that would say, nope, we need to – argue for that not just as our definition of marriage but as the definition of marriage and the only thing the state should recognize. And so I think there's probably latitude there. It's interesting to me to say, and the reason we're talking about this even on the podcast is just to say, I just think this is a question that's not going away and that Christians have to do better thought work on. And so in a sense, what we're trying to do is bring the listeners into this conversation and say, hey, let's do some thought work about what is marriage, because that our answer to that question matters deeply for how intelligent people perceive us to be in the conversation and how helpful we can be in framing up the issues in ways that help people see the unique distinctiveness of marriage versus other kinds of relationships. As I've read this book and pondered this, it even sort of changes how I think about marriage as a Christian pastor, because I think so many Christian couples, though intellectually they share a covenantal view of marriage, are so driven out of being in love with each other. You know, and so it's like the way they express vows and the way a wedding day usually goes is so focused on like emotional connectedness and love, and that's good. But it's really interesting to me that, man, it makes me want to value and honor more the vow and pledge component of a wedding ceremony and the significance of the coming together sexually of that couple and the sacredness of that, you know, and almost put more emphasis on sort of the covenantal and objective nature of marriage and less on the we really love each other and we want to get married. I mean, you know, these things go together, but I think in our culture, it's just even among Christian young people, there's such a leaning toward marriage being sort of a romantic day or a wedding day being such a romantic day. And I think this is getting us back in that direction of it. It's also a holy and sacred and significant day in a way that I don't think I understood on my wedding day. You know, it says something about the nature of personhood that I only had an inkling of on the day that I got married.
Yeah. And it's no surprise that that's the inkling because we are products of the romantic world, right? And so once things aren't romantic, then what are they? And that's why it has to be deeper than that, which is why this book makes us think so much deeper about marriage, because it is deeper. It's deeper than your romance. It's deeper than your feelings. It's a man and a woman coming together. It's hugely significant. I was reading last week just this tiny little book by C.J. Mahaney, and he says this. Chris, you mentioned the one flesh and how this What Is Marriage book reinforces the one flesh idea in Genesis 2. He says, the one flesh relationship is the most intense physical intimacy and the deepest spiritual unity possible between a husband and wife. And he doesn't give it a parenthetical statement here, but what he would say is that's not possible between a man and a man and a woman, right? Marital sex is the pinnacle of human bonding, and each encounter will lead you to a deeper knowing of the one you love. And so bodily, that's the reality of marriage.
And what's, going back to sort of the initial point, what is true in that one flesh, that spiritual intimacy, is reflected in the physical compatibility, that man and woman were designed physically to go together to reflect that. So you can't escape the physicality and the spiritual aspect of it. And when you do that, you're undercutting the inherent nature.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that the things that we've talked about might also be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. Please join the conversation by tweeting us at Corumdeo Omaha, and you can join us again next Wednesday on the Wednesday Conversation.
You can't touch this.